Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Knoll. This is the Progressive Commentary Hour. Today, the global crisis of transnational capital, economic, and social control over national economies. My guest from Santa Barbara, California, is Professor William Robinson. Professor Robinson is professor of sociology at the University of California at Santa Barbara. He is also the university's faculty of Latin American Studies and in Global and International Studies program. He describes himself as a scholar activist who is deeply involved in American domestic and third world struggles for social justice and popular empowerment of populations and participatory democracy and government. His areas of focus include globalization, transnationalism, political economics, immigration, and a variety of sociological issues. He is a graduate of the University of New Mexico and has published 8 books, his latest being Global Capitalism and the Crisis of Humanity. Nice to have you with us today.
Pleasure to be on, Gary. Thank you.
We have a lot to cover, and we need to touch upon a few of the main characteristics that describe the humanitarian crisis within capitalism, or transnational capitalism to be more precise, in order to better understand how modern capitalism in the 21st century is both structurally totalitarian and, in my personal opinion, sadistic. So please first begin by summarizing briefly the main characteristics of this global social apartheid that currently keeps 20% of the planet's populations affluent, or at least financially secure, and the remaining 80% of the population insecure and impoverished. And I'm thinking in particular the restructuring of physical space as a means of social control for transnational capitalists, and the problem of a surplus humanity, and how a new slave system is being introduced, and finally how transnational capital has impersonalized poverty and destitution and war and conflict, as, in fact, it's made it into entertainment for members of this new transnational class. The forum is yours.
Well, big questions and big issues. Let me just start with something very timely. If I'm not mistaken, these two reporters from the Associated Press won the Pulitzer Prize for their reporting on seafood slaves. And you know what better way to get insight immediately on what's going on with global capitalism and everything that you're touching on. I mean, this is widespread in the new global economy and society, the rise of this new slavery that they exposed, these two journalists that just won the Pulitzer Prize from Associated Press, that they discovered an island off of Indonesia where 2,000 men, largely from Myanmar, were literally enslaved, literally kept in cages and forced to work in cages, some for up to 20 years. 22 years was the longest time anyone was kept there. And the journalists exposed that, and so the Indonesian government intervened and released them, and it was big international news. But this is really the new face of global capitalism. You know, and one of the things that's brought us to this phase is that at one point, the capitalist classes were organized nationally, and of course, working classes and the oppressed were organized nationally, and so these battles, these class struggles and other social struggles took place at the level of the nation state, and the popular classes from below at times of mass struggle could force states to rein in a bit on the destruction of capital and capitalists, and introduce systems with at least moderated the worst aspects of capitalism. But starting in the late 20th century, capital broke free of the nation state, reorganized the whole system of global production and global finances and services beyond the nation state, beyond the grasp of any individual nation, and yet populations still are politically organized at the level of each nation state. And so this is something that has changed the whole structural balance of power worldwide and allowed what's taken place over the last 30 years, the rise of the new globalized capitalism, of neoliberalism, of new systems of slavery, austerity for the world's working classes, and so on. But, you know, Gary, before jumping into any more, I would say that we talk a lot about crisis, and that's what I've been trying to understand and analyze over the last few years. And for me, it's very clear that humanity has never faced such a serious crisis, which is why I termed it the crisis of humanity. The stakes have never been higher. We've definitely entered into a period of great upheavals, momentous changes, and uncertainties. And we're at a very decisive moment at this point worldwide. And, you know, we've been talking about crisis for a long time. We can identify three types of crisis. We talk about cyclical crises, which are these recessions that happen every 10 years, almost like clockwork. There was a recession in the early 1980s, the early 1990s, the turn of the century into the 21st century, and then, of course, the big collapse of 2008. But this is a more serious crisis than cyclical, structural, extreme version of a structural crisis. We say a structural crisis is when a crisis is so serious that the system needs to be restructured if there's any way out. So the 1930s was a big structural crisis, and that led to New Deal capitalism, social democratic capitalism, as the outcome. Of course, the outcome was fascism, but then fascism was, the other outcome was fascism, and that was defeated. And we see that right now playing itself out again. We're in a deep structural crisis, and the two responses that are in ascendance is the neo-fascist response, such as in the 1930s, and the popular leftist mass rebellion from below. So we're seeing that in the U.S. with, you know, one side is in these elections. One side is Trump. One side is Bernie Sanders. But worldwide, we're seeing this polarization between the far right and the leftist response. And so that's why the moment is so decisive. But I was saying we're in this deep structural crisis. The previous one after the 1930s was in the 1970s. And that is that crisis was resolved by capital going global, by capitalist globalization. And before that, there was a big worldwide structural crisis in the late 1800s. It led to a new round of imperialism, the formal colonization of Africa, and so forth. So we see these structural crises every 40 to 50 years. But each one has gotten worse. And this one is so deep, the one we're in now, which you can date it to 2008 to the collapse. I prefer to say 2001, 2002. But this one threatens to become systemic, which is the third type of crisis. And we say a systemic crisis is when the only way out of it is to change the system itself. That means, in this case, moving beyond capitalism as the only resolution of the crisis. And so we really do stand at a crossroads and a truly a crisis of humanity. Summarize in just a few seconds, and then maybe you steer me in where you would like me to elaborate. I identified sort of six dimensions that are novel to this structural crisis threatening to become systemic in the early 21st century that are different from crises of the 20th and the 19th and the 18th centuries. And one is what you already mentioned and what we spoke about last time is this incredible inequality, this unbelievable social polarization. You know, Bernie Sanders has brought to the lips of everyone the billionaire class in the United States, but this is worldwide. And as you pointed out in the introduction, humanity is divided into, on the one hand, the 1% of humanity and the 99% is global. And on the other hand, the 80-20% global social apartheid, where 20% are able to survive and a portion of that 20% to even prosper and 80% are experiencing this downward mobility and demise. So that's one dimension of the crisis. We've never seen such inequality at a global level. It raises all kinds of questions. How does the ruling groups reproduce this kind of a system with this inequality? Well, how do they purchase the loyalty of that 20%? How do they divide that 80%, co-opt some that can be co-opted, and then repress the rest of the 80%? How do you utilize consumerist fantasies to redirect rebellion against the system to simple consumer fantasy? How do you use, of course, the politics of fear and insecurity and racism and ethnic fear and so forth? I mean, all these are different instruments for trying for the ruling groups to try and reproduce a system of such unbelievable inequality. And needless to say, as you also pointed out, Gary, this extreme inequality obviously requires extreme violence and repression. So we're seeing the increasing social violence, political and state violence worldwide. So this is, again, unprecedented. Another dimension of the crisis which makes it unprecedented is we're reaching the ecological limits to the reproduction of global capitalism. According to the environmental scientists, we've already passed several planetary boundaries in climate change, the nitrogen cycle, diversity loss, and we passed these planetary boundaries or these tipping points in the words of the environmental scientists, we make it impossible for life, the majority of life, including ourselves, to exist on the planet. And so people are now talking. In fact, a journalist, I believe New York or New England-based journalist, Elizabeth Colbert, her book, The Sixth Mass Extinction, was on the bestseller list of the New York Times for several years. And she points out we've had five earlier mass extinctions in the 5 billion year history of our planet. The other five were caused by natural events over which life had no control, such as a meteor that hit the Earth and made the dinosaurs go extinct. But this time it's human activity transforming the planet in such a way so that most life is going to go extinct if we don't very quickly change the road we're on. And this is well known. And so this, I mean, this sets this crisis apart, to use the words of Naomi Klein. This changes everything. So another dimension that makes this crisis really unique and so scary. The third, you also pointed out in the introduction, the sheer magnitude of the means of violence and of social control around the world, the concentration of the control over the global means of communication, of the production and circulation of symbols and images. And, you know, just one example of this to link it to what's taking place in New York today, the votes, you know, the primary in New York. One study was done about a month ago, I saw it, by the Tidal Report, which pointed out that Trump, that the corporate media had a coverage of Trump relative to Bernie Sanders by 81 to 1. For every one time they covered Bernie Sanders, they covered Trump 81 times. So that's sort of what I mean when I say this incredible concentration of global communications and its ability for them, for dominant groups to control the communications, to control what news, in quotes, is produced, what information is produced and circulated worldwide, what information is not produced, circulated worldwide. And that means what we know about the world determines how we act in the world. So this is a deadly form of social control that's really, haven't seen this type of extended social control that goes to every aspect of our lives. And you also mentioned, Gary, in the introduction, the control of space. So you have this incredible technology of social control and information going together with restructuring space all around the world. Last time I was on your program last week, we spoke about global green zones, sort of multiplying all over the world the green zone that the U.S. occupation forces established in central Baghdad, where they were protected from the total anarchy and destruction and war around them. The U.S. occupiers, the military officials, the political officials, and of course the Iraqi elite. So we're seeing these green zones cropping up all over the world and shielding the 20% from the 80% and really shielding the 1% from everyone else. I want to come back some other time in some later on in the interview to point out, when we talk about the 1%, it's not just from the United States or even the rich regions such as Western Europe or Japan, but it's 1% is in Mexico, it's in Brazil, it's in South Africa, it's in China, in Indonesia, in Egypt, and so forth. But there's a couple other dimensions of this crisis that set it apart from those earlier structural crises I was mentioning, and one is that the system, you know, capitalism has to continue to expand. If it doesn't expand, it goes into contraction, stagnation, and collapse. That's why I compare capitalism to riding a bicycle. If you stop pedaling the bicycle, it stops moving forward and it falls. And the thing is that capitalism, the global capital system, experienced a new round of expansion in the late 20th century, early 21st. It incorporated the former Soviet Union. China and India were incorporated. Vast stretches of the countryside in the former Third World were incorporated into the system. And now there's no place left for the system to expand. Globalized capitalism has penetrated every corner of the world, and is the only system in existence. Even North Korea is setting up free trade zones and maquiladora industries. So question is, where can the system now expand? And since it can't expand territorially, it's shifting into new forms of keeping itself going without that expansion. And one of these, and this makes it so scary, is militarized accumulation. What I mean by that is that making wars and destruction and creating systems of mass state repression and police repression becomes a way of accumulating capital in itself, independent of the political objectives of this type of accumulation. I call it accumulation by repression and through violence. And the big example we have in the United States, but again, you see this all over the world. You can analyze all these social conflicts. All these conflicts breaking out everywhere is a boon to a capitalism that no longer has any way to expand. But the U.S. example is how the current war against immigrants, there's always been a war against immigrants for the last 100 and some odd years, but it took a really ugly and intensified turn in the last few years. Obama's the deportation president. And under Obama, all of these anti-immigrant laws have passed in states around the U.S., the most notorious being Arizona, with that famous Arizona anti-immigrant law. And that law was drafted by ALEC. That's the American Legislative Exchange Committee. And ALEC, as many of the listeners probably know, brings together CEOs of the leading Fortune 500 corporations with elected officials at the state level and the local level. And they get together periodically throughout the year, and the corporations pass on to the elected officials legislation they want enacted at the state level or the local level. And in turn, those corporations finance the campaigns of these local politicians. Well, they met in Colorado right before the passage of the Arizona anti-immigrant law, which sparked all these other copycat laws all over the U.S., and ALEC, the particular member of ALEC, corporate member of ALEC, that drafted this was Corrections Corporation of America. They drafted the anti-immigrant law, and they gave it to the Arizona State Assembly representatives, and the Arizona governor, who was present at the meeting, said, go back to Arizona, please, and pass this law. And that's exactly what they did. And, of course, the two state representatives that were there, plus the governor of Arizona, Jan Brewer, were also shareholders of Corrections Corporation of America. They passed this law, and that unleashed this new and horrible round of repression against immigrant communities. But why did Corrections Corporation of America do that? It's not even that they're necessarily, the individuals that did it are necessarily racist. Maybe they are. Or they're not necessarily against immigration. In fact, they're not. But simply because by passing anti-immigrant laws, you create all of these private immigrant detention centers and immigrant security forces, and then immigrants are rounded up, and then you make profit. And that's how you keep on accumulating in the face of stagnation. So that's sort of this example of militarized accumulation or accumulation through repression that we see all over, and it sets this crisis also apart from earlier ones. The fifth dimension you already mentioned as well, the rise of the surplus population. We spoke about that last time, but we really need to connect all the dots in this and how a rise of the surplus population is making possible the new types of slave labor, such as the seafood slaves, and is also making possible and desirable for capital and for the powerful, the construction of prisons and so forth. The dimension of this crisis, which sets it apart of earlier ones, is the extent of the state meaning the U.S. state, but really worldwide, states everywhere, and what I call also the transnational state, suffering a crisis of legitimacy. And that could be good in the sense that if the masses of people could stop considering the powers that be and how they're organized in states to be legitimate, then we'll create a new system. So it might be good, but the fact is that this crisis of legitimacy leads ruling groups to take desperate measures to try and reimpose legitimacy. And so you get Trump's discourse, trying to reimpose legitimacy among a sector of the U.S. electorate. And so the other thing about the crisis of state legitimacy is, if we're going to rein in on globalized capitalism, and I'll conclude with this, or at least conclude this very long, response to your question with this. There's two ways to rein in on the anarchy of global capitalism, bring some stability to the system, some sense of humanity to the system. And one is obviously to overthrow the system and create a more humane one. And wonderful that that happens. But the other is to have some type of a political power that can impose itself on the recklessness and anarchy of global corporations and global capital. And traditionally, that would be the state at the level of the nation state. But now the state can't do that at the level of the nation state, but we don't have a global government, or we don't have a transnational state apparatus that can really impose and stabilize the system. And that's why you even get these elites, very well-known elites that used to be all for neoliberalism, capitalist globalization, unregulated free markets, such as Jeffrey Sachs, just as Lawrence Summers, not friends of working people at all around the world, poor people around the world, who are now clamoring for reform of the system to save the system from itself and from a more radical response from below, and are clamoring for some type of a transnational state apparatus that can bring about that reform. So a lot to discuss here, but that's
that gets us all from running.
Yeah.
It's, from my perspective, I would add the following. Mm-hmm. We have to look at how they've been able to exploit the poor in this country. For example, forget the national loan debt and the corporate debt, which is $26 trillion at the corporate level, because most corporations wouldn't exist without the debt they were able to accumulate. And the equity partnership deals where one company buys another company using debt and then overloads the company they purchase with so severe a repayment plan that it's inevitable they're going to collapse. Mm-hmm. Think of Linen and Things. Think of Circuit City. Think of over 3,000 companies that were fine with no debt, but now they have this debt, and yet the people who profited were Bain Capital and people like Mitt Romney and the other equity partners out there. But for the average person, the big way you profit is you give people the idea that they should make debt into an asset. And hence, mm-hmm. when people feel that they need something or want to pay for something, they will use a credit card. And they say they're going to give you back 1.5% to 2% with every purchase. What they don't say is you're giving us 18% to 19% to start. And then if you miss a payment or late, it can go to 28% and on up to 100%. With payday loans, it can start as low as, if you miss the first payment, is 300% and go to 1,000%. And we're talking about tens of billions of dollars a year mm-hmm. people make off the poor who cannot afford this. Then on top of that, segueing into what you said, if you cannot pay your debt, you can be arrested. You can be put into a debtor's prison. Now, the irony of it is, if you were too poor to pay a $40 ticket, this is an actual case of a woman, and so they arrested her, they put her in jail, and then they charged her $125 a day for being in jail. Then they charged her to go before an administrative judge that is a privatized judge, and then he gave her a probation officer, which is a privatized probation officer, and she had to pay each of those. And she found that she couldn't, so she went back into jail, accumulating more debt. And the only way she could get out was to have all of her relatives, who were also poor, chip in, sell a car, and got her out. That only got her out of jail. It did not pay the original debt. And today she has spent over $700 based upon a $40 ticket, and she's not alone. There are millions of people. In addition to that, the government now is doing something that we don't even talk about. In the New York Times, no one will discuss it, and that's asset seizure. Last year, almost $4 billion was stolen by police where no one was cited, no one was given a ticket, a fine, no one was accused of a crime. If they like your car, they confiscated your car. They confiscated people's homes. They confiscated some businesses. But most importantly, when you're pulled over, they will ask you, how much cash do you have? You say, I only have $700. Well, give it to me. Why? Because I believe it may have come from drug dealing. Well, it couldn't have come from drug dealing. Here, I got the deposit ticket. It doesn't matter. Give us the cash. So here we have legalized out-and-out theft by billions of dollars. No one is dealing with it. The attorney general is fully aware of it. That makes her complicit. It made the former attorney general, where this started, complicit, Eric Holder. It made the president complicit. It made the entire establishment that understands any way they can exploit to extract money, they will, since they cannot create new businesses. But on top of that, one of the worst pillagers of people is the International Monetary Fund. Mm-hmm. Now, the International Monetary Fund has created hundreds of billions of dollars in profit by going into countries, giving the corrupt rulers or those in charge some advantages, then tying in with their multinational partners to build a dam that wasn't needed, a road that wasn't needed. And then when the company cannot repay it, they go in and give them an austerity program. Structural adjustment, it's called. They're doing that right now with Greece. And they will say, for us to continue doing business with you, we want you to privatize your roads, your water, your electricity, no more subsidies, cut back on pensions, break all unions, open up your oil fields or your gas fields or whatever resource they have for outside partners. And suddenly a country no longer has sovereignty. They are under the thumb of all those people who are in that Washington and Wall Street loop that will go in like Goldman Sachs, a criminal organization in my personal opinion, and they will exploit it as Goldman Sachs did with Greece. Now today, Greece was told, you want $89 billion? You can have $89 billion, but we want you to take people already dumpster diving, already extreme poverty, and we're going to increase that. You're to fire more public employees, close down more agencies, reduce more public services. You don't have to pick up people's garbage. You don't have to provide people with any subsidies for food or education. If they can't afford it, don't let them go to school. If they can't afford to be sick, then don't have them be sick. But now we're going to privatize your healthcare system. You're going to privatize your airports and all your ports. And unfortunately, the corrupt people who run Greece have allowed this to happen. And yet, where would that $89 billion go? Not a penny would end up in Greece. It all goes to pay the bankers and the people who are making billions of dollars off financing very high interest debt. And as a result, the people of Greece should have broken out, gotten out of the European Union, told them to stuff their debt, and made deals with countries that would allow them to continue to function, go back to an original currency, and put the money they do have back into a people's bank and break free of all this. But they're not going to, because of the fear that somehow the European Union is a good thing. And it's a terrible thing. But everywhere I look in the world, I see this. Now, one other thing. I'd like you to focus upon some of the people who caused this. For example, I happen to have a lot of respect for Jimmy Carter after he left office. I think what he did for Habitat for Humanity, I think what he did for recognizing and calling out Israel's racist and apartheid attitude towards the Palestinians, putting him in the largest prison, the whole population of Palestinians, for all intents and purposes, that's what they are. He called them out. But also, let us not forget that during Jimmy Carter's career as president, 1977 in Zaire, after the CIA-sponsored assassination of Patricia Lumumba in 1961, and Mobutu Sese Seko ruled, was the absolute dictator for 16 years. And then along comes Carter, and they knock him out. Then you got Guatemala in 77, and where, again, horrors by embargoing and then sending death squads in there. Then East Timor in 1977. And then you had with Henry Kissinger. Then you had Afghanistan in 79 and Angola in 78 and El Salvador in 1980. And so no one ever thinks about Jimmy Carter being responsible for the destabilization of entire countries and the legacy of death and destruction by allowing pro-American corporate interest regimes to take place. Now look at Hillary Clinton with Honduras, and look at Hillary Clinton and Libya and Syria. So we can't talk about people being poor, disadvantaged, homeless, and union leaders being killed and pro-democracy activists being detained and killed, unless we give this a face. Hillary Clinton and Bill Clinton are faces that were responsible. Jimmy Carter is a face of response. Ronald Reagan was armed the Contras. The Bushes armed everyone. So why don't we take a look now at that as leading to the destabilized world that we live in today? Because without them in office, we would not have had the power go to the 1%. Your thoughts, please.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. I want to follow. I don't disagree at all. You're completely right. I want to follow up, though, and point to one dimension of sort of the political face of this global system and all its crimes, and then the more hidden from view corporate face of all of these crimes. So look at the example, because you mentioned the Clintons, and clearly Clintons have a big share of responsibility for this global crisis, for where we're at. So do the Bushes. So do all of the dominant political elite in the United States, and well, like Kissinger, Reagan, Carter, all of them. Look at what Clinton did, and a lot of people have spoken about this, but it's just so outrageous. The elected government turned to the left, a little bit to the left, not even a lot. Mel Zelaya, and in 2009, he was ousted in a military coup. It's not clear to what extent the U.S. knew beforehand about the coup and let it happen, but what's important is that Hillary Clinton was Secretary of State, and she did everything in her power to make this coup, military coup, and military takeover a success. She blocked the return of Mel Zelaya. He was taken away in his pajamas by the military at dawn and dropped off in Costa Rica, kicked out of the plane. And then she publicly, her declarations were, you know, we're against this takeover. And she wrote in her book, and she had published her book, Hard Choices, and she had the hardcover come out, and the hardcover edition exposed what she was really up to. She said she wanted to quickly organize elections in Honduras, of course, under the military control. So, and people were being shot at, you know, repressed left and right. They couldn't participate in these elections, even if they'd wanted to. And she said, we're going to hold these elections in order to legitimate the coup regime, and we're not going to allow Mel Zelaya to return. But the exact words that she used is, we're going to render the question of Zelaya moot. That's what it says in her book, Hard Choices, the hardcover edition. Once that got out, and once people started talking and pointing out about her role in propping up this military dictatorship in Honduras, which, of course, is still in power, she changed it and took that sentence out, or that little section out, for the paperback version of her book, Hard Choices. But this is the record. And about a month and a half ago, Berta Cáceres was assassinated. I'm sure your listeners all know about that. She's one of the most important leaders, not just in Honduras, in all of Latin America, an indigenous indigenous leader of the mass movement in Honduras. She was assassinated. And shortly before she was assassinated, she singled out Hillary Clinton, saying that this is the one that backed and made this coup irreversible. And Hillary Clinton had the nerve about 1 week ago, when asked about this during one of her electoral campaign stops about the case of Honduras, in fact, in New York, she said this in New York and at the Daily News, in fact, that the coup was constitutional, so, something so outrageous. But here's the point. I want to link, Gary, to what you were saying. Right after the military takeover, the Honduran government, with the assistance of the United States, organized a giant fair, which they called Honduras Open for Business. That was the title of this fair. And the global 1% from all over the world descended on Honduras. There were Mexicans, there were Saudi Arabians, there were South Africans, Brazilians, of course, the United States and Europe. All of these were corporate leaders, with some politically, all corporate, the corporate ruling class worldwide. They descended on Honduras to see, now that there's a military government, now that the threat from the left and the social movements, they believed, was over, how could they gobble up Honduras for their corporate greed? And so that's sort of what I want to get at, that the who's responsible for what with humanity is facing is in part the political face of global capitalism, the Clintons, the Bushes, the Kissingers, the et cetera. And in part, there's the hidden face of the corporate chiefs. And so everywhere you see these crimes that are conducted by the United States, the intervention in Libya, the intervention in Iraq, Honduras, Chile, wherever you go around the world, and the other powerful states in the world, you see that these crimes are committed in order to open up space for corporate capital to take over, to expropriate millions of people, and to generate new forms of profit making and exploitation of working people all around. So you were mentioning the International Monetary Fund, and absolutely the International Monetary Fund is a key part of this whole story. But when they build the dams, here's where I might add on to something you said. Some of these dams are not needed for most of the people in these countries. But the dams are needed by transnational corporate capital, because it generates electricity, which is not going to go to lighting people's poor people's houses. The electricity will go to maquiladora assembly plants, and it will go to transnational agribusiness, which has taken over the countryside and so forth. So even you see these institutions, the International Monetary Fund, the World Bank, controlling the levers of economic power in order to open up space for the corporate order. And one other point, follow-up, Gary, to what you were pointing out, is another, absolutely, the debt that you were mentioning, the consumer debt, and then the repression now against those that are in debt and debtor's prison and so forth. But the other dimension of the debt that we want to remember in analyzing where we're at is state debt. And here the right wing in the United States constantly says the debt is too big and, you know, it's out of control, et cetera, et cetera. But that's simply rhetoric. That's intentionally political manipulation. Because the debt, when a government issues bonds and goes into debt by issuing those bonds, the people that purchase those bonds are the banks and the corporate sector and the wealthy. And those bonds are paid back with interest. And who pays back those bonds with interest are the working people of the United States or the particular country, whether it's Greece or the United States. So really, the incredible debt of governments, including the U.S. government, including the Greek government, and so forth and so on, is a way that transnational capital has of sucking more wealth out of the hands of working people around the world through the state and through taxation, regressive taxation, and through paying back these bonds and this debt. So it represents a further transfer of income. Debt is great. State debt is great for the banks. It's great for the wealthy. It's great for the corporations. And so that's another dimension of this, of debt. Go ahead, please. Oh, you're going to say the other case that's so outrageous specifically, again, the primaries are taking place in New York today, of Hillary Clinton with regards to Latin America, that it just, I believe a month ago, very recently, several thousands of her emails and cables were released. And so we're still sifting through that. But revelations is that she was actively, while Secretary of State, supported the U.S.-Colombia Free Trade Agreement, even though publicly, when she was senator, she said she's against that agreement because of Colombian human rights violations. So it's simply two-faced. The emails revealed that she was fully behind in lobbying the Democratic Party in Congress and working very closely with the repressive Colombian government to pass that free trade agreement. It was passed. And that Colombia is one of the most dangerous places in the world to be if you're a trade unionist. In fact, Coca-Cola workers have a global campaign to boycott Coca-Cola because every time they try and organize trade unions in the Coca-Cola factories in Colombia, the local Coca-Cola people hire death squads to knock off those trying to organize trade union drives. So you can't be a trade unionist in Colombia without facing death squads and state repression. You can't be a journalist without running major risk, not to mention low wages and the expropriation of some 4 to 5 million people of their lands in recent years. And so this is the deal, the free trade deal that Clinton, as Secretary of State, promoted. I mean, just one of endless examples.
In order for us to posit the idea that the U.S. is a totalitarian state ruled over by transnational capitalists and influence peddlers, we would need to conclude that private global capitalist interests have taken over the nation's and even our government's finances and thereby have control over how these finances are used. And this would require a structural mechanism to be put in place that enables private transnational economic interests to dictate politics. And one example would be how right now the most lethal economic product on the planet are derivatives. Four American banks, including Goldman Sachs and J.P. Morgan and Bank of America and Citi, they control over $400 trillion, or four times more than all of the gross domestic product on the world. And yet, if anything goes wrong with these bets that they put down less than 1% against, we, the public, have our savings in banks completely privatized. It's no longer considered a deposit that we own, but rather is now belonging to the bank. And then they are first in line to get repaid at 100 cents on the dollar. That would bankrupt the entire world. And yet no politicians talking about it, no media is discussing it, and the idiots on these talking head shows, the faux people on these economy shows never mention this as if it's non-existent. Well, it's very much existent, and yet you couldn't have done that unless you had control over the power brokers at the Treasury and in Congress. You couldn't have gotten that a provision that we, the people's money in the banks, no longer belong to us. It belongs to them. They're first in line. We're not. We would get some worthless shares of stock if the banks couldn't pay us back. And we wouldn't get the FDIC paying us because the FDIC is insurance based upon on our deposits, but not if our deposits are then converted into investment shares, in which case there'd be no insurance protecting us. So people would just be wiped out. And then those gated communities, and then there'd be enough of pain for people then to say, these green zones are not going to hold us back. And I see that day coming. We're not in enough pain yet. We've got a way to go before Americans. Unlike people in other parts of the world, their deprivations, their privations are phenomenally more painful and self-aware than we are suffering in our society. So we're not there yet. But when the day comes when the average American can't feed themselves or their family, when they're facing starvation, when a whole nation is considered domestic terrorists for speaking up and stepping out, and when the complete machinery of the state is unleashed against them, when they start seeing innocent Americans being shot in the street, which would happen in the blink of an eye, you would have more people willing to kill other Americans. There's no shortages of people who would back the totalitarian police state in a heartbeat. And there is no compassion, there's no empathy, there's no spirituality in any of the people who've ever run this country, and there is not now. So that is what I see. Is it a bleak picture? Yes. Is it a realistic picture? More than realistic. Your thoughts, please.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think to start with, you identified a key, what we could call a structural feature of what's going on right now, and so important to understand. And when you say that we agree that we live in a dictatorship of transnational capital and its political agents, and how is that possible? Well, because of the incredible concentration of economic power in the hands of very few people, very few corporate conglomerates. And it's a sociological law that economic power translates into political control and political influence. So we know the story about elections being funded by the wealthy, by the media being controlled by the wealthy, so that's the message that gets out. And then we know the story elsewhere around the world, how economic power can put dictatorships in control to exercise its political influence, how this economic power can invade a country and set up a system of political control. So, if it's the United States, and as you were speaking about, but anywhere in the world, the incredible concentration of economic resources in the hands of a few means political control one or another way. And really, the one that you identify, or the two that you identified most importantly, is first that the planet is being held in hock. Humanity is being held in hock and as hostage to transnational finance capital. I mean, that figure of $400 trillion is just unbelievably phenomenal. And we can analytically say that what's going on is the structural power of transnational finance capital is exercised over the direct power of governments and over the power that we're able to muster from below, the organized working class and oppressed groups. And so we have to address this structural power, really structural dictatorship of transnational finance capital. But, you know, the other thing is that we do stand, of what you're saying, we absolutely stand, in my view, at this crossroads. And again, we're seeing, as I mentioned at the start of the interview, this polarization worldwide between a neo-fascist response to the crisis and a popular leftist revolt from below to the crisis. And so you're asking, you know, at what point does the global revolt overwhelm the system? And we might be headed towards that. And the key question is, how are those from above going to respond? And with mass repression, as you mentioned, but the other question really is, how will the masses from below respond? Will a significant portion be co-opted into supporting, you know, fascism and dictatorship, as you're pointing out? And that's where I have not at all given up hope. And there's a lot hopeful going on in the world. In much of this interview, we've been analyzing the nature of the new global capitalism and those that are in control of it, the misery they're unleashing on humanity. But on the other hand, if you just look just at the United States or anywhere around the world, there's a global revolt has been underway for quite a number of years now. It's had a few setbacks. If you want to date it, it's always resistance, right? But if you want to date the last 15, 20 years, a mass revolt really began in 1999, 2000, 2001, against the 25 years of Reaganism in the United States, neoliberalism worldwide, capitalist globalization. 9/11 of 2001 put a damper for a short time on that global revolt, but it picked up dramatically after 2008. And then this year, 2015, 2016, it's taking off everywhere again. In the United States, you have an environmental justice movement, which it's stronger than ever. You have a racial justice movement. You have an immigrant justice movement. We have reinvigorated worker struggles from the $15 an hour fast food workers' minimum wage to the occupation last year, sit-down occupation of Walmart, something unthinkable just a few years ago. And then you have in France now the rise of a new Occupy movement. I forgot what they're calling it. They don't call it Occupy. You have the upsurge of the struggle among the Palestinians and international solidarity with the Palestinians. Despite the repression we spoke about in Honduras, you have unbelievably powerful social movements in Honduras, some of the most powerful in the hemisphere, and in Haiti. You have an incredible escalation of worker strikes and worker organizations in China, on the coast of China, which is now the workshop of the world. So wherever you go, we have the fight back from below, and not a neo-fascist fight back, but a popular transformative fight back. And this big challenge is this fight back faces. In Greece, the fight back was, you know, the structural power of the bankers, and how did the government bend into the structural power of the bankers? In Egypt, the big challenge that the fight back faced is that a dictator took over again and was derailed. Syria degenerated into war. But so really, the key questions this raises for me is what types of transformative projects can we struggle around? And first of all, and secondly, how can all of these different fronts of struggles in each country, such as the United States and worldwide, how can they link up with one another around some minimally agreed upon project of transformation and project of confronting global capitalism and this dictatorship of transnational capital? And how can we transnationalize all of these struggles? Capital, it's been said for a long time now, and it still is worth saying again, capital transnationalized over the last 30, 40 years or so, and resistance to it, more than just having solidarity with people in different countries, the actual resistance needs to transnationalize. It is happening, and it needs to deepen. So we're at this crossroads, and all is not bleak, but if we don't seize this moment, we don't seize this moment and change things around, we are headed for the crisis of humanity.
Less than 2% of the American population is actively engaged in any form of social issue, not just social change, social issue, even joining a foundation, being put on a mailing list to see how animals are treated or see how the environment is impacted. And we have very few victories. But that does not mean that we will not gain in momentum when, and I believe the only way that any movement at all, the vegetarian movement or any others, will ever have a capacity to have a quantum leap ahead is when the government overreacts and then forces people to look at a situation deeper than what they normally would. When I look at our military adventures in Afghanistan and Iraq, I observed the operations were far more than simply occupying these nations and controlling resources. On the one hand, even there were many failures. These operations that involved numerous private corporate interests were too sophisticated and costly to be regarded solely as military invasions. In many respects, especially when we look at the extent of private corporate contractors and surveillance structures put into place, these invasions appear to be more like laboratory experiments to fine-tune social and economic control over populations in the future. What are your thoughts?
Unfortunately, you're right about that. I actually did not know that only 2% of people in the United States are involved in any social issue, and that's very disheartening. And I wonder if that's still the case in the latter part of 2015, 2016. But as far as these adventures being laboratory experiments to fine-tune social control and repression, absolutely. Absolutely, and a lot has been researched and written and discussed from the perspective of those from below on the militarization of cities and how national borders and restructuring of cities so that there's population containment zones. Absolutely. I mean, absolutely. Something like the invasion of Afghanistan or Iraq brings together all of this. It brings together, as you put it, a laboratory experiment to fine-tune systems of social control with the militarized accumulation that I mentioned earlier and with turning war and turning violence and repression into forms of profit-making.
I'd like to come back for a moment and revisit the attention we should pay on Hillary Clinton's legacy as the Secretary of State. In the past, I have given attention to her meddling in the Ukrainian coup to oust the Russian-friendly President Viktor Yanukovych, and several programs on NATO's taking Gaddafi out of Libya. In both of these cases, the nations have degenerated into human development and economic catastrophes, although Ukraine was economically struggling at the time of the coup. However, we did witness a gateway of private American corporate interest rushing into Ukraine as soon as the new right-wing fascist government came to power. And when you look at a list of these companies, you would think that the U.S. strategy was to transform the Ukraine into a private industrial park for American firms, Monsanto, Cargill, Coca-Cola that you mentioned earlier, Citibank, Chevron, Exxon, John Deere, Intel, Boeing, Eli Lilly, just to name a few, since the coup in 2011. She also similarly called out Hugo Chavez in Venezuela as a dictator.
Yes.
In similar terms as she did Gaddafi, and tried to create division between Chavez and Brazil's president, Da Silva, during her visits to Brazil. However, we have not looked at the coup against leftist President Manuel Zelaya in Honduras in any depth in the American media, not at all. And this coup, like Libya, has Clinton's fingerprints all over it, including her attempts to have what she called free and fair elections held, all the while that anti-coup leaders were being assassinated. And since Clinton is running for election at this moment, with polls still open, still undecided about who will get it, Sanders or her, and the major media also not giving Sanders a chance and all on support of Clinton, then they're not going to report anything on the true Honduran situation. So would you give us your perspective on how much of a super on steroids war hawk that Clinton, the Clintons, have been historically, and not to mention Yugoslavia, and the fact that he bombed in the Sudan, bombed a pharmaceutical company, and he would do whatever he was told to do.
Yes, well, Hillary Clinton is the very best face of war and militarism worldwide, and an agent of transnational corporate control. And I say the very best face because someone like Trump generates so much opposition. I think the latest poll said 67 or 72% of people in the United States don't like him. The thing about Hillary Clinton, or someone like her, is that she frames her discourse and carves out her own image as someone who is progressive, as someone who's bringing human rights and democracy and progress and opportunity to humanity. And some people fall for that discourse. And so she is, in some ways, her presidency, if she won the presidency, would be, on the one hand, would offer absolutely nothing to 80% of humanity, to the world's people, except more crisis, more militarization, more war, more corporate control. But on the other hand, she has more of an ability than other political agents of this global corporate order to forge hegemony, or at least it would appear like that. What I mean by hegemony is that there's always been two ways in which you maintain control, and one is direct coercion, physical force, whether it's the police, the armies, what have you, courts. And then there's consensual domination, which means enough people, by the argument coming from above, by the dominant groups, enough people are lulled into passivity or enough people are culturally co-opted that you have this type of consensual domination and a balance between coercion and consensus. And certainly Hillary Clinton is dangerous in many ways because she attempts to forge war, militarization, and corporate control through hegemony and through a discourse which is really 180 degrees opposite of her actual practice. So the world's people are in for some worse times, some very bad times, if she becomes the new leader of the United States. I just say that, yes, she is absolutely progressive on certain social issues, such as the rights of lesbians and gays and voting rights for the whole population of the United States. And that's extremely important. I don't want to downplay that. But put that side by side with the damage to the entire world's population, to the planet of 7 billion people at this time of crisis, and it's quite scary.
I'd like to finish up today with just a thought. And one of these thoughts were, you motivated me to thinking about this because in our last discussion, you discussed that people have to have what you called structural power. And this is something common in fascist governments, whereby economic mobility is completely controlled by either a political or corporate elite. And also, they almost always have to have ideological control. And this is the danger in our society, where we're distracted by entertainment, by spectacle, by violence. Mm-hmm. as if we are passive voyeurs to it and not realizing this is real. But that ideological control means that the six major media that control over 90% of all the information we receive, they're sophisticated enough that they can actually colonize and suppress the minds of a population. It reminds me of what the great Professor Henry Giroux calls the violence of organized forgetting. And this is the normalization of violence in a society, either through constant mass surveillance, we have that, the militarization of domestic law enforcement, we have that. Young kids in school now are being policed and arrested. We have the massive private incarceration system that hovers over the nation like a dark specter, and public austerity programs and slashing social welfare, and the nation being in a perpetual state of war against terror, which even Dick Cheney said would be there for 50 years after 9/11. And this intentional creation of a culture of fear is specifically designed to pacify the American public and subtly force it to relinquish its faculties of critical thought, reasoning that might otherwise lead to dissent and rebellion. And now we have criminalized dissent. We have criminalized rebellion. We have even criminalized a person who may think without stating. There's now a whole new program where the National Intelligence Agency has been shifting files and into police headquarters, and based upon everything you've read, everything you've eaten, everything you've done, every movie you've seen, everything you've participated in, they now have a profile, psychological profile for those who may at some time in the future have anti-corporate or anti-government feelings, are now being targeted and categorized. And you see where this is going, the ideological colonization of the public mind and the structure that has been put into place to enable it. And I believe that we are there now. It's just a matter of how bad will it get when the maintenance of a system and a person's needs is no longer in place before you implode. You have 1 minute to finish up, please.
Gosh. Yeah, I think what we have, I agree with everything you said. We're at an age of thought control. We're at an age in which 1984 looked pretty good compared to what we're going into now in terms of ideological control and cultural domination and really this thought control. But the only thing I would add is that we need to take, we meaning those of us from below, the mass of humanity struggling against the system, need to take advantage of this crisis, because it's also, as I pointed out at the beginning, a crisis of legitimacy, of state legitimacy, the legitimacy of the ruling groups. And so we need to take advantage of the fact that the system has its legitimacy being called into question. And I've always said that, I mean, what's the obvious, that we need a massive redistribution of wealth and power downward to the poor majority. And part of that are the mass social and political struggles. But a part of that is also putting forth an interpretation of the crisis and this moment, and what is the opportunity that we have in this moment of crisis. And so we have to put that discourse out there. That's really, again, the key thing to summarize, to repeat again, that the moment, this moment of crisis offers grave dangers, but it also offers opportunities. And one of the things we want to do is interpret, identify those opportunities and give our interpretation of this crisis, why we're in it.
I agree with that. Thank you very much. The book is Global Capitalism and the Crisis of Humanity. My guest, Professor William Robinson, Professor of Sociology at the University of California, Santa Barbara. Thank you very much for being with us again.
Thank you so much for having me on.
I'm Gary Nall. This is the Progressive Commentary Hour. Thank you all for listening.